Welcome to Electronically Yours with Martin Ware.
Hi, it's Martin here. Electronically Yours as always. Today's very exciting guest is somebody I've admired from afar for, well, forever, since the mid-80s, really. His name is Dave Gamson. He's the keyboard stroke synth producer, arranger, songwriter with Scritopolity from their major three albums, which were Cupid and Psyche, Provision, and Anime and Bonomy. He was co-writer and co-producer on all those albums with Green Gartside, of course, who's a good friend of mine. I'm so glad that Dave, who I've never actually met, amazingly, I met Fred Mayer, who's the drummer from that band, but I've never met Dave, and I've been an enormous admirer of his for years. The amount of stuff he's done, I didn't fully realise until I started doing my research, and his background as a highly trained traditional composer, kind of potentially wants to be a classical composer. But he was always a big fan of funk and soul, which explains quite a lot. So here he is, the amazing Dave Gamson. So let's start at the very beginning with your... Because your mum and dad were both involved, they were both creative types, weren't they? So tell us about them.
They were, yeah. So my dad was... a pretty legit musician, went to Juilliard, was a conductor. And, you know, we always had music around the house. And my mother was a pretty actually famous dancer, modern dancer, who did recreated a bunch of Isadora Duncan stuff and was pretty celebrated in her time. Which it was actually, she went back to it as a solo artist in her 40s.
Wow.
And then became quite famous, actually. So, you know, they definitely like to think of themselves as bohemians. So that was the household. I'm not so sure.
One of my favorite words, actually, bohemian, because it speaks directly to how people think about themselves.
True. I think that's what it said more than the actual facts, but yeah, that's how they considered themselves. My father, however, sort of hit what a lot of musicians hit, which is I think that he had a lot of success in his 20s, and then he kind of hit that lull in his early 30s, which is, and then he was saddled with a family at the same time, and so... His opera company went bust.
Oh, shit.
And then he tried to do a few other things, like in advertising and stuff, and it didn't kind of work out. And I think he felt a lot of pressure. And he actually just took a job with, like, arts administration with the County of Westchester, which is where we lived in New York.
Right.
And that was really what he did for the rest of his life. And I think always had a lot of disappointment about not having pursued... you know, the dream. He never talked about it. Like, he never talked about his early career ever, even if you pushed him.
But could he, I mean, I suppose, I've never been trained classically, so I wouldn't really understand all that world. Although I've obviously mixed with a lot of classical musicians. But wouldn't he be able to continue, or was it too painful to continue composing and being creative?
He played piano all day long, right, every day. Like, if he had any free time, he was playing the piano.
Wow.
And he was, like, an amazing, like, he could sight read scores. You know, he was really a good reader. he was not a great piano player, but he was, like, a really knew his stuff. And then the other thing was, in the 70s, he got very interested, oddly enough, in electronic music.
Yeah.
So he did a continuing ed program at Queens College in New York, where they had a modular Moog and a Buchla. They had a whole, and he actually did some computer music stuff at that time too, which was in its infancy.
Yeah,
which,
yeah.
He'd come home with all of these punch cards, which you would, so you'd have to, I don't even know what that was, but anyway, you'd have to punch out certain things, and then you'd stick it in the computer, and you'd get, like, you know, 10 seconds of and which he was thrilled by.
How brilliant. And what did you feel about computer music at that point?
Well,
I mean, how old were you at that point?
Probably 12 or 13 or something.
That's quite
formative. And then at which point he bought an ARP 2600.
That's not a normal thing to do. You know that, don't you?
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
Really, a beautiful influence for you.
Yeah, no, it was insane. I remember getting it, and then he also put together a Tascam 4-track and a 2-track, so he could bounce between the two.
Yeah.
We had all of that at home.
Wow.
Yeah, so that was, you know, a huge influence, and you know, that was like basically what I started doing everything on was that ARP 2600.
Wow.
And he would stay in that. He just was completely enthralled by synthesis. So he'd like work on a sound for like a week on the 2600 and then he'd go like, come here. And he'd pull me into the studio and like hit one note and be like, it never repeats.
Yeah, I'm still like that. I can waste time with the best of them. It's interesting because the parallels between me, who's not classically trained, but I did learn everything I know through just experimentation on modular synthesis.
Right.
As a producer. And I'm fascinated to get your view on how that influenced the way that you constructed productions and arrangements in the future, having that as like in your core DNA of your creative process, that appreciation of timbre.
Well, of course it made a huge difference, but also you know, he pretty much put me in sort of classical music training from age 5, so that was in there too.
Yeah.
So, you know, at 5, he was like picking instrument, violin or piano.
Right.
So, you know, I guess it was like, yeah, the combination of having all that electronic music around. And then, you know, I did have a sort of a foundation in sort of legit theory and stuff. Although now I can't remember any of that, but. I guess it's in there.
Oh, you can do ridiculous.
I think it does. It really helped with, I do like voice leading. All that stuff is still there. And I do kind of like, there are certain things that I just won't do, particularly with vocals, like based on the voice leading stuff that I learned as a kid.
So explain what you mean by voice leading.
Parallel fifths, parallel fourths, all that stuff, which is like, I mean, it's there for a reason because it doesn't sound so good, but it's always, I do think about it, especially when I'm doing vocal arrangements.
If you'd not been trained, do you think it's in your soul to understand this sort of stuff? Because I know it is for me, because I literally only found out the theory after I did the practice, if you know what I mean.
Right.
So do you think if you'd not had that classical training, that you, how would that have altered your future career, do you think?
Impossible to say. But I do think just through the years, I do have a kind of different, which has nothing to do with the training. I do just have a way, and I think I'm sure you do too, of thinking about harmony that I don't think has anything to do with the basis in classical training. I don't think of chords. I never learned the whole jazz naming of chords and stuff because that wasn't part of my upbringing. So I think I just think about it a little different. I have my own little weird way of thinking about stuff. I'm sure you do too, because I think we all kind of like.
I remember seeing the sheet music for Luxury Gap when it first came out, and I'd know red sheet music, well, set in school or something for recorder. But. And I'm going, fucking hell, it's in 5 flats. I'm a fucking genius, or, you know, 6 sharps, or I don't know what it was. But anyway, so
did you have you didn't have any, like, musical training? Oh,
none whatsoever, no.
So what was your introduction was strictly through like just messing with synthesizers?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. And monophonic synthesizers.
Right.
I mean, my very first synth was a stylophone. You know,
and you're kidding.
And actually then I thought I was Eno because I've got a dual stylus stylophone, you know. And
I haven't even seen one of those. Is it two layers?
No. It's one stylophone keyboard, a bit bigger than a normal stylophone. And it's got two styluses, so you can play two notes simultaneously. And it's got a bunch of switches, a bit like stops on an organ or something. But it's also, the interesting thing is it's got a photoelectric cell, which you can use for volume or wah-wah, which is really cool. So you can use it for expression, you know, and stuff like that.
Right.
Anyway, I thought it was fancy. It's all I could afford at the time.
Right.
There's an enormous clarity in your productions as well. And there's a sort of definite appreciation of kind of, hocketing and
right. Which is a word I never heard before. I actually saw it in reference to me, but now.
Is that right?
I had never heard that word.
I'll tell you what, you should go and I learned a lot from this. There's an album by Wendy Carlos called Secrets of Synthesis.
Oh. Yeah.
And if you can find it online, you might have to go to her website to buy it. She's a bit eccentric. It's amazing because it describes all the different techniques that she's used in her compositions. And that's right. Where I learned the word hocketing from.
Right, okay. Now, I will say, Switched on Bach was like a huge moment for me as a kid. Yeah.
How old are you now?
Actually just turned 61 yesterday.
Oh, well, I'm 5 years older than you, so you're okay. Just all got the hair, at least. What was I going to say? So, yeah, that's a great album. You should try and get hold of it. And also, for any listeners who are out there who've not come across it, it taught me an awful lot. But the one thing, because I did a couple of singles with Green after, I did the...
the Beatles.
And the other one. I can't remember where it was now. Anyway, but when Green came into the studio with like some basic demo parts and played them for me, I thought, this is great. And I thought, we can definitely do something with this. So then we started on the process of constructing it. And it's like, he was going, right, it's all these little blippy blocky sounds, right? He's going, and it's going, this is the beat. And it's going, beep, bop, bop, bop. You know, and I'm going, right. What the fuck is going on here? And then like, about 7 or 8 tracks later, it turns into this amazing polyrhythmic pattern. And I'm going, this guy has got a musical stave running in his head all the time. But the one thing that I thought about the stuff that you were specifically involved with is the sheer heart-wrenching beauty of the chord sequences, which
thanks.
I presume that was that you or was that Green? I mean,
at least on that, like, so for the at least Cupid and Psyche era, the only like of the stuff that he had already started or written, I never got like demos of that. So it was like, either he played on a guitar or something,
right.
And then
did all the keyboard arrangement.
Yeah.
Right.
So, there's like a floating around somewhere is like the original demo that he did of Woodbees or something, which is like, it's almost like country and Western sounding, but it sounds like something off of Songs to Remember or something. And that's really, at least that's the way it was presented to me. So, the arrangement, that whole take on it was me.
Great.
So I would change harmonies and, I kind of, the basis of the song was there, but
Yeah, the way these interlocking, I view it as a kind of cogs of a giant fucking funky machine.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly how I think of it.
And it's like it all fits together so incredibly well. I mean, that to me, those albums defined that period for me. I mean, it was, I cannot explain to you how influential it was on Heaven 17. I mean, we were...
Really? Wow, interesting.
Oh, yeah. I mean, massively. I mean, the sounds and the clarity and the... We didn't want to sound like you guys, but it was an inspiration to hear the beauty of the arrangements. A bit like listening to, you know, kind of Trevor Horn or something, or it was on that level for us.
Right. Wow, that's like, the highest compliment, really.
Yeah. Well, really, man.
But later on, like, he did then start to do, I guess it's just because also nobody had home recording. Later, he would start to do, like, when we did Anime and Bonomy, he had demos. And then we were stuck, which was probably just after the period you worked with him, actually.
Yeah, that's
so true. By that point, and then, like, for that record, we pretty much stuck to the arrangements.
Oh, really?
Okay. The roles were totally different by that point, though. So, like, for Cupid and Psyche, it was much more, like, collaborative on the musical side. So,
right. And so Anime and Bonomy was more like you being a producer behind the other side of the glass. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Because he really had, like, a vision for what he wanted that record to be.
Oh, I must have distorted his cultural development. Before.
But yeah, like, it was always like, I do kind of think in that sort of pointillistic, it's like little bits of little things. And the older I get and the more I do this, the more macro I become in terms of, like, thinking about the whole thing. Even though it's constructed of a lot of tiny little bits, I'm much more concerned now with the overall.
Oh, yeah.
And how they all interact with each other. Like, well, I don't really even think about like synth sounds anymore, because everything's constructed from these tiny little bits. So it's like, it's not like, oh, I'm going to find a synth sound that's going to work through any portion of this song. You know, it's going to play one thing, an event.
So, do you ever do any teaching?
I haven't.
Would you be interested in doing
that? I'm totally interested, yeah.
Because you have an enormous breadth of experience in lots of different genres, and I would have thought you'd have made a perfect teacher, because you explain this stuff really quite well, I think.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, no, I actually would really be interested, but it just, I don't know, hasn't come my way.
I'm the same with film soundtracks. Every single podcast to mention the fact I'd like to do it, and nobody's asked me yet.
Well, okay, I have I've had a little experience, because I worked on I was, like, part of the crew in the Hans Zimmer thing for Mission Impossible 2.
Right.
So I was, like, kind of in the mix over there.
And I see Hans Zimmer as a kind of black hole that absorbs influences in this irresistible magnetic field. which aggregates people's talents and reputation. That's how I see him.
Well, I just was going to say that any of these things, whatever you've done outside of, like, any, I just have discovered that any part of the music business is just as competitive as every other one. So it's not like, even if you've made some amazing records and had a whole career, it's not like that has any meaning in this other part.
None whatsoever. That's right. I've actually interviewed a few people, as you probably know, if you've listened to the podcast, a few people who've worked with Hans Zimmer. I'm fascinated with him. I want to get him on the podcast, actually.
Oh, yeah, you should.
I think he'd be quite good on that.
Very interesting, very smart.
Yeah, super smart. I actually kind of knew him a little bit back in the day when he started in the 80s, and he was clearly destined for big things, but he was
right. It's funny, because I remember from the 80s, like, every studio we'd go to, there'd be, like, some ridiculous modular setup somewhere, sitting somewhere, and they'd be like, oh yeah, that's Hans Zimmer's. And I was always like, Hans Zimmer.
Where's it getting money from? That's what I always think about Kraftwerk. You know, their families must have been very rich.
Possibly, yes.
Yeah.
Although they were really into the kind of buying cheap little devices and using them too.
Yeah, but then on the other side of the coin, the commissioning Robert Moog to design kind of modules for them, and I'm going, this was when, you know, I had about 50 quid a week to live on,
in the mid-70s.
Anyway,
but we were still renting since for Cuban Psyche because we didn't own anything.
Really?
Yeah, we only had maybe a DX7 and an MSQ-700 to sequence.
Really?
But we didn't have a lot. Yeah, we'd rent a bunch.
And what were the keyboards that you were using at that point? Cupid and Psyche? DX7?
Yeah, so DX7 came out sort of midway through the project, I think. Maybe it was at the beginning. We definitely had a DX7. So, and then, I was sequencing it all on a MSQ-700, which was like, I think, the first MIDI sequencer, Roland, which I still have. And I think we had a Jupiter 8. I definitely had a Mini Moog, which I still have. I don't think I even hardly used the ARP-2600, but then we rented in like a PPG.
Right.
Can't remember. There might have been a couple other little things that we rented in. I think we had a Lindrum, and we borrowed an 808.
Can't go wrong with Lindrums, can you? It's still, to me, the greatest.
But a lot of that early stuff was real drums.
Yeah. So we doing loops? Or was it all live played?
Yeah, it was live playing. So it was... like the first few things we did with a reef was like live drums that we just recorded, just the drums, on their own. And actually, I think like on Woodbees, it was just the kick and snare, and then we overdubbed the hat.
Right. Yeah, that's what I used to do at that point. Was I used to hate it when drummers turned up with a huge kit and all this stuff.
Right, you just have to take it all out.
Get rid of all that shit. Don't know.
Right.
Don't know toms. You can put the gong away,
Right. No. But I actually, weirdly, I wrote out, because Arif wanted all the charts written, so I wrote out the drum part.
What?
So he actually read it.
Shut up. Really?
Yeah.
How wild is that? Okay, so drums, yeah. It's just so, I tell you what, the other thing that really struck me, particularly with Cupid and Psyche, when it was brand new, that sound, it was like, it all sounded so supple, but kind of under control. So it was like this kind of hybrid. It felt like a hybrid between programmed and fluidly funky as well. And I just think that's the sweet spot right there. Yeah. We were always a bit more, with our productions, always a bit more chaotic than that, but it felt very mathematical almost, in a good way. Because the greatest funk is quite accurate, isn't it, if you think about it? I think.
Precise, I guess, yeah.
Well, I mean, it has to syncopate around a really fixed thing.
Yes, true. Well, there was, the early, the stuff we did with the reef was kind of a hybrid between playing, mainly because there were limitations for how much stuff we could actually sequence at that point.
Right.
So by pretty much the minute we could sequence all of it, we were sequencing all of it. But then, there was a lot of playing with laying stuff back in time and moving stuff around. Yeah. Yeah. And also, like, everything was cut in little tiny bits again, so you could just, worry about getting this little part to feel good.
Right.
And that was the other thing is, like, once we built layers, that was a way to make it feel like there was some movement.
Yes.
By having things, you know, come and go.
And just going back to Oh Patty for a second, I know it's on, you know, it's, you know, just a thing of exceptional beauty, of course. It's like a kind of jewel box, I think, that track. But I was just listening to it again now, just before I came on here, and it's the vocal arrangements, the backing vocals are so beautiful and so much like a kind of dream.
Yeah, that was this guy, Eric Troyer, who we brought in as like a session guy, who was like fantastic at all that stuff. He had all these like interesting techniques for how to record them and stuff. It was, he was really great. Yeah.
Because it reminded me a bit of 10cc's.
Very, very much. So for some of those really long notes, they had this fantastic technique where, because it was him and his friend, whose name escapes me right at this moment, but they would each stand on the mic, one with their back to the mic and one front, and they'd turn around as they sang the note. So it sounded like one continuous note.
You're kidding.
No.
Now that is wild. That's like,
isn't it?
That's like meat space looping.
It's like very low tech, but very ingenious.
Oh, man. You should have put them on little rotate.
Like on a lazy season.
Like some kind of game. By the end of the song, they're completely dizzy. That's right. Just genius.
Yeah. And they were so good that they would try to mess with each other. So if you listen solo to the tape, before they came in, they would just sing random notes to each other to fuck with each other.
Right.
So that they wouldn't come in on the right note. And of course they would, but that's like a little game with each other.
That's interesting.
But anyway, a lot, yeah, that stuff was, they were on First Boy in This Town, on that same album. All those background, like Beach Boys harmonies.
Oh, I love all that stuff. I'm so in love with that. We used to do, with Hem 17, we used to do, you know, a huge number of backing vocals. I mean, like 120 tracks for certain things. And all had to be, of course, manually bounced in.
I was going to just say, if you were on analog tape, Jesus.
Boy, that's the power of cocaine.
I don't know why we didn't do those things with Green, to be honest, but we did get this guy, Eric Troyer. I don't know why.
I think he sounds more fun.
Really?
Yeah. Anyway.
I can't remember why we didn't do it, why we didn't just do it with Green, but maybe it's because he just had the vocals generally at that point were taking so long that maybe we just thought it would be quicker.
Well, to tell you the truth, the backing vocals on that sound like from a different plane. You know, they don't sound like normal backing vocals. They sound dreamlike. And I just think, it's just a thing of beauty I've always loved.
Right. I mean, I think that mix was really nice. It was this guy, Mike Shipley, who has passed away. Oh, a great mix.
No, it's amazing. So tell me about my other enormous favorite, Absolute, which I think is one of the best things ever in a nightclub.
That mix is Gary Langdon. He just killed it. Yeah,
I used to in Sheffield, in the clubs we used to go to, a little bit more alternative 80s, it would just be an instant floor filler. You know, as soon as the opening Absolute,
right?
Everybody's going, we're on, we know when the drums are coming in.
The mix definitely sounds great. That was really like, the song was just a Green song, so I can't take credit for that, but the arrangement was, I definitely did that, except for that whole middle bit, the gamelan.
Yeah, all right.
Arif actually wrote that all out.
Shut up.
We went to Ned Eben. Do you remember Eben Ozen?
No.
Okay, they were like a kind of a New York dance electronic band, and there was a guy, Ned Eben, who had a Fairlight.
Oh, so it's doing a Fairlight, isn't it?
And we went down to his studio, and Arif had written out that whole middle bit, and we like basically programmed it out using the Fairlight. So that was That was Arif's bit.
So tell us about working with Arif, because I'm an enormous admirer of his career.
Oh, God, how can you not be? Yeah.
I mean, obviously, a common thread for these kind of quality of producers is that they have a kind of seemingly bottomless desire to keep up with current trends, you know. And
very much so. And he was always like, you know, is it modern? Is it like, he was very concerned.
I'm not modern enough yet. I did meet him briefly once. Oh. Such a sweet guy.
Oh my God. He is. Well, first of all, it's like that generation of record guys is, I don't think we'll ever see that again. Those guys, it's like, he's from a different generation. So I say, and he was also just extremely refined person. You know, he was from a very wealthy family.
Right.
So he, you know, he was just a very refined gentleman.
He seemed to be, yeah. He was very kind of polite and, you know, very, yeah, he was a gentleman. That's the way I'd describe him.
Yeah, he came, you know, he was always dressed beautifully.
Yeah, he had a fine tweed suit on when I saw him. Yeah, he was good. Okay, let's go back to your influences.
But by the way, he was so supportive. I have to say also, because I had done nothing before that. And we had done like demos essentially of all those three songs we did with Arif, yeah, which I did the arrangements for. But, and then like suddenly Arif was producing and I was like, okay, well, that's the end of me.
Oh, and right. I see. Right.
And like the first day I get a call, first day of pre-production, I get a call and it's Arif and he's like, didn't you do these arrangements? Yes. Well, get down here.
Oh, that's
yeah. And he was so supportive of just throughout my whole career. And he would like use me as an arranger on things.
Really?
And, I mean, yeah. I mean, he was just a great guy.
So what other productions did he and arrangements did he employ you for?
There was, oh God, what was that woman's name who did the duet with Phil Collins, which went to like number one?
Oh, the guy from Earth, Wind & Fire.
No, girl.
It was girl.
Yeah, it was like a big ballad.
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, that's the thing.
All right.
Unmemorable.
So
he did a record with her, and I did an arrangement on that. That's the one I'm remembering, but like, I just, he was always like, just, I was quite friendly with them for after that for a good few years with the whole family.
Wow. Well, I'm jealous because talented guy, very talented guy.
Yeah. I mean, if you go through, there's so many records where I'm just like, oh shit, I didn't even realize he did that.
Yeah. Yeah. Loads of them, loads. So you work with Chaka Khan.
Yep.
Who I also did some stuff with. But
I did like most of a whole album, actually, which was never, I was staff producer at Warner Brothers from 90 to 95.
Wow.
So it was like a producer A&R gig, and I did it during those years. But what happened was,
were you on salary?
Yeah.
Fuck.
Yeah.
I've dreamt of having a salary as a producer.
Oh, man. It's messed me up for the whole rest of my life because yeah. I realized what having a salary was like.
I know, it helps, doesn't it? You can actually plan your life.
It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry, carry on.
But at the end of that, there was a big regime change where Mo Austin left. They started DreamWorks after that. But I sort of made this whole record, which culminated in the regime change. So yeah. It kind of got lost in that whole regime change, and that, you know, it never actually came out as a record. Little bits of it came out on like her greatest hits and stuff, but
yeah.
I did do one single on the Woman I Am. I did the single off of that, which was actually did pretty
good. Is that Love of a Lifetime?
No. Yeah, no, okay. Very similarly titled Love You All My Lifetime, which I didn't write it.
Oh, okay. And you worked with Al Jarreau.
That was just a cover, actually, of a song
it?
That Green and I wrote back in like the Scritti days that Niall produced.
Okay. And oh yeah, I know. I was going to ask you. How did you get Miles Davis involved in recording when you were...
So he did a cover of Perfect Way on the Tutu album.
Right.
Which is... It was pretty strange and amazing. Because apparently he was signed to Warner Brothers and they would just send him all the releases from Warner Brothers.
Right.
And he just picked that song. Like, it wasn't like he heard it. Like, he just, from listening to other releases on the label, he keyed in on that. Crazy, right?
Well, it's not really, because I think, you underplay how... authentically musical, that your work is and Scritti's work is. You know, I think there's an enormous amount of respect in the music industry for it. There you go. I don't know what you say to that.
I nodded. But because he did that cover, it was kind of a reciprocal thing where he appeared on our record. And he also, like, you know, during that period, he would, you know, I think Green got those calls too. You'd get these calls where Mr. Davis is on the phone for you, and Miles would come on the phone, and he wanted songs for his next record.
Oh, I see.
So right. I think he was hitting us both up for material, and I was like completely intimidated and didn't know what to do because I was completely not a jazz guy.
No.
So
Benny wants to be contemporary, and I suppose you symbolized that kind of...
Yeah, I remember I played him something on the phone that I was, like, working on, and he was like, yeah, that's cute, or something.
The thing is, it's hard for people who are so knowledgeable, maybe in the jazz scene, to kind of reverse engineer simplicity. And I've always admired his, you know, beautiful melodic take on what he does and everything. But it's hard for people to unlearn what they've learned in jazz terms, I think, sometimes.
I don't know. I mean...
You're allowed to disagree. It's all right. It's just my fault.
I mean, knowledge is... I don't think you can have too much knowledge.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Okay. We'll agree on that one. I think actually it can be...
I mean, is there any other subject that you would feel like that about? Like... Other than music, like, would you think, yeah, I don't want to learn about that because it might mess me up?
I think I've noticed amongst a lot of session players, for instance, if they are some of the most musically trained, highly trained, technically brilliant guitarists, for instance, there tends to be a correlation between that and maybe... not so much creativity or going off piste because they know where the piste is. Anyway, it's a discussion for another time.
But that's an interesting discussion.
I mean, I think there's a certain truth to the idea that if you don't know when you break in the rules, then it kind of frees you a little.
Yeah.
No,
we'll have to just agree to disagree on that.
Okay, we'll agree to disagree. So I think that the combination of funk, beautiful kind of classical songwriting, I suppose, not necessarily, no, I don't mean classical music, I mean music, songwriting in the classical sense of the word, and combine that with new technology and the electropop is essentially the sweet spot which you hit and what we were always aiming for and only occasionally glimpsed at. Funk has been a big influence for you, hasn't it? And soul.
Definitely. I mean, definitely in that sort of late 70s, early 80s, right at the cusp between programming and live playing.
Yes.
Was a very interesting period for me musically. So, like, you know, the height of Leon Silvers to me was, you know, hugely, hugely influential, which is, and to me, the best Leon Silvers stuff was actually just before the programming
Right.
Took over. So.
And you liked the system as well, didn't you?
Huge. Yeah. I mean, I was pretty friendly with David Frank too, but they were like, I mean, they were a huge influence on me. And David's work.
I think he's going to come on the podcast. I can't wait to talk to him because he was
the nicest guy ever too.
He was a massive influence on a lot of people. I know. I'm very good friends with Living in a Box still. And that was their go-to thing. It was the system, right? That's what they wanted to sound like. People like Go West and stuff like that as well.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, definitely that was like a game changer when that, like, its passion came out, and then, which was before You Were My System, and then... and then You Were My System, which I still think today is like, and then, oh my God, what great record.
Fantastic. Terrible video, but great record.
Just the, you know, just the, those bass lines in the intro, it's fantastic.
Yeah, superb. And the way it's so kind of jerky, but funky, actually, you can hear it in your arrangements as well.
I mean, I don't know if you're even on, like, David's, like, he's a Facebook friend, and occasionally he'll post stuff, and it's still, like, everything is, like, it so sounds like him, and it's so fantastic.
Really? Oh, yeah. My God, I've got to get onto that. So tell me about your relationship with Green, how it's evolved over the years.
Right at this point, we're quite friendly, so, you know, we exchange emails often. And, you know, if I'm over there, we'll definitely hang out. There was a decade after the making of Provision where we really didn't speak.
Really? Why was that, do you think?
We just wore each other out, I think. That the making of that album was just not fun. And we just, I mean, I was physically ill at the end of it, like for months. Really? Just from exhaustion.
And was that to do with, because I mean, I didn't know all this.
It just got into so much craziness. And, you know, when you work, it would have been better to just write some more songs at a certain point, but like you just keep working on the same songs for a year.
I'm not speaking out of school. I've told him this. When we were working together and I was producing, I said, you know, I often say the metaphor is he would really try to revise things too many times, and he would find it hard to come to a point where he could just say, this is an authentic expression of me at this moment in time. I'm going to let it go.
He's gotten much better at that, though.
I think so. But we had big discussions about that when we were working together. And I said the metaphor for it was the dart player's dartitis. You know, when they can't let go of the dart.
Oh,
it's actually a thing.
That's a good. Oh, really? That is a good metaphor.
And it's like, keep lining it up. Oh, my God, it won't come out, you know. And I used to say that, and he used to laugh at me, but... And I think, I hope I had an influence on him in some respect. Anyway, the track.
When I met Luther Vandross along the line, he was saying, you know, you guys, if you could stand at the record store and grab the records away from people after they bought them, you would. And say it's not finished.
Yeah. There you go.
And that's kind of true. Because
you like that as well.
Kind of. Like, I will mess with something ad infinitum, yeah.
No, you got to stop that shit. Just get it out.
There is a point at which I'm done, but like certainly, in those days, like you were done when the money ran out. That was when we were done.
Hmm.
You know, at a certain point, the record company was like, "Yeah, no, we're not giving you any more money," and that was kind of like, "Okay, I guess we're done."
But that's a lack of self-discipline, ultimately.
I, to be honest, I can get to that point now, but with a DAW that I couldn't get to then.
Oh, I see.
So I don't know that it was like indecision or frustration with the tools.
I see. That makes sense to me.
And we had every, you know, we had like, I don't know, you know, in Provision, we had like every piece of gear in to try to do what we kind of heard in our heads, but it wasn't really possible totally to do it. Like we had the, I don't know if you remember, there was like a PPG HD, HDU, our disc recorder. Yeah. One of the originals, a four track, we had that in because you were supposedly, you could fire off samples through MIDI off of it and like it totally didn't work. But like we were definitely trying to push it, and there were like limitations to what the.
But what often used to happen in those days for several bands was, you know, the classic one was the Human League. So our manager used to manage them and Heaven 17 at the same time for a period.
Right, and by the way, us, Bob Last.
Is that right? Did he manage you guys?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Okay, yeah. That's interesting. Okay, so nice guy. I still keep in touch with him.
I listened to the podcast.
yeah, he's a nice guy. He would say to us, oh my God, I've just been down to Air Studios and they're working on the second Human League album. Said they've just spent days auditioning kick drums. And I'm going, oh my God, no, I can't deal with that. And I think ultimately, when Martin Rushen walked away, it was because he couldn't deal with that level of option.
Somehow, I mean, it wasn't, that was kind of that era because suddenly you could do that. So I think everybody had to get that out of their system because I think it wasn't, there were so many people who were, you know, would spend a week on a kick drum. And then I think it was just because suddenly you were able to do that. But, you know, the reality, of course, is that the same kick drum in three different songs sounds like three different kick drums, you know, so like, the kick drum doesn't exist on its own.
No, as we found out by trying to
right, but them. Right, but like I think at the time you could mess with it, and you were like, "Oh, we're going to have the greatest sounding kick drum of all time. Let's pursue that."
Man, that's fucking madness.
Right, and you know, and then it was like, okay, we got the greatest sounding kick drum. Now let's get the greatest sounding snare drum of all time.
I remember when the Fairlight first came out. And Ian had bought one. I thought, just turned up at the studio one day and here's a £30,000 Fairlight. I'm going, oh, I probably wouldn't have bought one. I would have rented one first. But anyway, so we thought, well, we'd better make use of this. So we hired in loads and loads of percussion and cymbals and da-da-da-da, recorded it all into there, and it just sounded terrible coming back off the machine.
Right, 8-bit samples.
It's 8-bit samples. It sounded terrible. It was like, I'm going. We ended up ringing up Australia. You know, the designer said, oh, yeah, man, it's a quantizing noise. You know, and I'm going, it's 30 fucking thousand pounds.
Right. So what I think in the later Human League stuff, and we did too, and I'm sure you did too, which was then you started sampling into the AMS because that was 16-bit.
Yeah, and I know, well, got an emulator too, which was much better.
Okay,
yeah.
I think that was 12-bit, right?
Yeah, but it still sounded great.
And right, then, yeah.
And it would actually be close to reproducing what...
But I think like on Fascination, they had, like, I think the bass line was a series of AMSs.
Was it?
No.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, I think they were just triggering each note from a different AMS. That's what the story I heard.
Is that right? Oh, my God. That's ridiculous.
But we did that, like, on Perfect Way, the kick was in one AMS, the kick ambience was in another two AMSs, the snare was in one, and the snare ambience. So, like, that was a thing.
What was your kit hire bill like?
Oh, yeah. I mean, those records just cost a fortune.
Yeah, I mean,
but there was no way to do. Yeah, you know, you couldn't really record at home at that point.
No, you couldn't. No, and I remember we had no idea what we were spending. Probably the same. I mean, to us, it was just like a blank checkbook. So we were in Air Studios, and it's only later that we found out it cost over £300,000 to make Luxury Gap, which we didn't recoup fully until 2002.
Oh, but you did recoup, huh?
Yeah, we did recoup. No, you didn't. Okay.
I actually don't know. I've never seen a dime of royalties from any of that stuff. Yeah.
Shit. That's no joke, is it? So let's have a look where else we're at. So you work with Michelle and David Cello.
Yep. Right? Did her first, most of the first one and all of the second one.
Oh, great. I love her.
Yeah, those were fun. That was sort of that period at Warner Brothers, which so.
Oh, you were this where you were staff producer and you were getting all yeah. these gigs. You lucky bastard, and the wage as well.
That, yeah, so I was like that. I did that. I did the Shock record. I did a record with Roger Troutman there, which was super fun.
He's the man.
He really and Keisha. Was. What?
Keisha as well.
Yeah, so that was like. You know,
much later,
a decade yeah. or two later, but yeah, that kind of that was like 2010.
Right.
So I did like did a lot of the sort of artist development of that sound with her.
I like that very much.
So, yeah, she's great. She's great. And then I was kind of, that at that point, I was kind of like, that was the I'm going to try to be just a songwriter. Period.
All right. And why did you think that?
Well, production fees.
Yeah,
yeah, plummeted. And I don't know why it took me so long to realize that like copyrights were really where the money is.
That's right.
So somewhere along the line, I realized, oh, that's actually, I got to stop looking for the quick money on production gigs and really concentrate on being a songwriter. So I kind of started concentrating on just, you know, being an LA songwriter and pitching songs and stuff like that. So that was like, Kesha was different, but from that, was that period where I was just really just trying to concentrate on being a songwriter rather than didn't really worry about the production side,
right.
which was that led to the Kelly Clarkson cut, which was, I was just like purely as a songwriter. So, and that was kind
a great
of
song.
The high point of that.
Yeah. That was Grammy nominated, right?
Yeah. Number one Grammy nominated. Yeah. That was a good one.
So you earned plenty of money out of that, presumably.
It was good. Financially.
Bravo. Bravo. Okay.
I mean, I realized that between like, cause Kesha sold really well. It was like, that's a whole nother level.
Right.
Oh yeah. I really hadn't experienced before.
And what are you working on currently?
Actually. So starting just before the pandemic, I kind of got a little burnt on the pitching songs thing and that. So just before pandemic, but then I started working with an artist named Hannah Diamond, who's on PC Music. I don't know how aware you are of the whole PC Music hyperpop movement. It's genre.
Tell me, tell us, tell the listeners.
Well, it's like, it's pretty much a global genre at this point, but she was one of the sort of original artists on PC Music. And, I'm now doing most of her record, which is going to come out next year. And right. I'm just having a blast. It's so much fun. So it's like, it's in some ways similar conceptually on some level with Skritti, because it's like the intersection of perfection and the fallibility of humanity. It's like these, so it's like everything is very, it's artifice is, mostly what it is. So it's like there's not a lot of reality in it, but right. So it's sort of take, which, you know, it's taking this gritty thing a lot further, but it's like you know, just a lot of sound design and manufactured stuff, and it's super fun for me to work on because it's all just sound design.
Great.
So, yeah. But and great songs. So
yeah fantastic. Well, we're coming to the end of this. It's
I dread this rapid fire. Yeah, you know, it appeals to my like my performance anxiety.
Oh, give over. Do you get performance anxiety before going?
Horrible. I can't perform ever. No.
Really?
Yeah. I have insane stage fright.
Wow, that's not fun. I think Green's a bit like that as well, isn't he?
He kind of got over it.
Right.
It's like, you know, they've been playing live for the last few years. He seems like he enjoys it now.
I tell you one thing, before we move on to the questions, the recording his voice is an interesting thing because it's so he sings so quietly. And it's such a beautiful, delicate instrument. It was like, it was not a challenge, but it was a surprise.
It is a challenge, especially if on a track that's pumping.
Yeah.
It's a challenge, yeah. To figure out.
Right, it's even more of a challenge.
Oh, true. Yeah.
He sings so quietly.
You got to really watch where he is on the mic and stuff because it's like that. There's a weird bottom end build up too.
Isn't it?
Yeah. So, okay. Yeah.
So, you're not performing. You just there's no right and wrong answer.
Okay, let's see how I do. I can always just pass on the question.
Okay. What's your favorite film? One of them.
All right, one of them is definitely 2001.
Oh, yeah, me too.
And then, you know, yeah. From the sublime to the ridiculous, I would do the Big Lebowski on the other side.
Yeah. 2001.
That was kind of a big life changer for me as a kid when I saw that.
I remember seeing it recently. They re-showed it at the BFI in London on a 70 millimeter print. And you know, original, it's so beautiful.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
This is a piece of art.
Yeah.
You know, just gorgeous. Anyway, favorite TV show, past, present, box set? Anything?
Can't think of anything. That's my favorite. I do
and
watch
that. Or you listen to the podcast and you still. You've had all this notice.
Yeah, I can't.
Do you not watch TV?
I do watch TV. I just probably that's why I don't have a favorite. I don't really have. It doesn't. Yeah, I'm going to pass on that. And also, let me just preempt the book one. I don't have a favorite book.
Okay. Well, you are ruining this. No, you're not. Okay. An epiphanal moment in your life.
I definitely think getting that ARP 2600 at home for sure.
Yeah, that's a good answer, I think. Who's your favorite other musical artist? And I'm going to ask you, because you come from that background, who your favorite composer is as well. Since you've got two questions.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, it's sort of the intersection of the Beatles. Probably McCartney more.
Right.
And then the discovery of funk music where those, like, you know, so Bootsy and
Funkadelic.
Yeah, Funkadelic. And so those were kind of like the two pillars.
Yeah. Have you ever met Bootsy?
Never.
I worked with him on a record.
Really? Man, what a genius.
Oh my God. He turned up to the studio and immediately tried to sell me his merchandise before he'd even introduced himself. Hi, Martin. Would you like to buy a cat? You know, and he's handmade.
Yes, please. I would.
Yeah, I bought two. I don't know where they are now. Anyway, he was gracious and beautiful and everything.
If you listen to those like bass lines from the James Brown era, it's amazing what he's doing. It's
fluid, yeah.
Yeah, totally fluid, yes. Good way to describe it.
Yeah. What about a classical composer?
Webern? And Bach.
Bach.
But yeah. I do love me some serial composition.
Yeah, me too. Bach. In fact, the bass player from Penthouse and Pavement, John Wilson, who was 17. And this magazine asked him who his favorite who his favorite bass player was, and he said Bach.
Yeah.
I'm going, fuck, you know, this young black kid from a council house in Sheffield. You know what I mean? But
yes.
Anyway, okay, song you wish you'd written, or what, the one that you just think is like as close to as good as you can get.
All right, I haven't heard this one before from you.
That's why I'm throwing some new ones in.
Okay, you ready for a left field one?
Yeah.
Because it just popped into my head.
Yeah.
Cliff Richard, It's So Funny.
Wow.
Yeah, right?
That's proper left field.
That record made a huge mark on me.
It's so funny, I don't even know it.
Alan Tarney. Great pop producer, English pop producer.
My first film I ever went to see was Summer Holiday. But anyway, Cliff Richard, fuck me. Right.
It's a great pop record. With a million key changes, by the way.
Really? I'm going to check it out as soon as I get off this. Do you like visual art? Are you interested in that at all?
I'm not really, but I actually love architecture, so like Frank Lloyd Wright.
Okay, cool.
Love.
I went to his house, and outside Chicago, isn't it?
Really?
Is it?
How cool.
Yeah. There's a whole, where he started his kind of domestic architecture is in like this village just outside Chicago.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And then, and it was bloody amazing. It's like a completely different world. You know, anyway, I'm a big fan as well. Okay. So where are we? Unfulfilled ambition.
I would, to steal your thing, I still would love to score a film.
We should do it together. That'd be cool.
You can find one.
I'm so desperate now. I'm trying to scrape it. You're in.
Like, early on, I know what I wanted to do, and I just somehow never got to it.
But you're in LA, right? You must know loads of people who are involved in films.
I do. And I'm always asking.
What the fuck? It's all the people whose best mates have got the gig forever.
Right. So it does seem like at least your first entryway has got to be knowing somebody who knows once you're in, it seems like you're in, but it's very hard to get in.
And okay, what's your favorite synth?
Does it have to be hardware?
No, can be.
Well, if it was hardware, I'd probably do go with the 2600 just because it's like it has some. I have an emotional connection with it. I still have my father's 2600 over here.
Do you?
Yeah. Shit. But I'm mostly a plugins guy at this point, so I'm like completely in the box. So I don't really use hardware at all anymore. Do you?
Oh yeah.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a collector at all. I mean, I've got rid of just about every synth I've ever had. But every time. In fact, we were just talking about this with my young, the guy who helps me do the podcast is a young engineer, writer guy called Chaz. And every time we're stuck for an idea for a remix or an arrangement or something, we go to the Korg 700S, which is like monophonic synth from the mid-70s, or the Roland System 100. And every time we go to it, we go, I know it's a bit of a faff to use it, and I know it's not MIDI, but Jesus Christ, it sounds so much better than I've got all the virtual synths. There's just no contest. But anyway, it's just my view on the whole thing.
Right. I guess it's just for me, it's like, it's not, again, like I said before, it's not so much the sound, but it's, there's so much programming of the automation for everything that is like, I just couldn't ever do it in hardware.
Well, you could sample it as a piece of audio, and then that's what we do, and then just manipulate it.
Right. That's already too much of a commitment.
Oh.
Like, I like to keep my options open.
All right. Fair enough. I'm a big fan of making decisions at every point in the production process.
I think that's probably a good lesson I should learn, but
I think we're all pretty much of an age where things are going to change too much now. And that is it. You'll be glad. No more performance anxiety.
Oh, it's fantastic.
You've done your duty. Thank you so much for doing this.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I've been really enjoying listening to the podcast.
I'm
honored to be part of it.
Well, listen, as you know, we've got some really cool people from America as well, you know, and all that kind of...
I love the Jam and Lewis one. That was great.
They're my all-time heroes, possibly.
Man. Yeah, legends.
I mean, those records, those Janet Jackson records are just sublime.
I mean, yeah, those and so many others.
So many others, exactly. But also, you know, like Dr. Fink and all that stuff, and, right. and the Prince crew and all that.
Right.
Oh, my God. I mean, to the very thought I'd ever get to talk to people like that is just beyond my comprehension. So
it's been great to listen to, so.
Thank you, man. Cheers. Yeah. Well, you have a fantastic Christmas. And
yes, you too. Great to meet you finally.
2023.
Oh, also, at some point, I want to pick your brain about Italy and movies. It's
oh,
like
shit.
A fantasy.
Oh, really? Are you serious?
Yeah, so we'll do that separately.
Yeah, yeah. No, please do, because I'm about to buy another place in Venice. So.
Right. I definitely want to pick your brain about that.
I looked, when I first bought my place 30 years ago, I looked in lots of different places in Italy. And so I've got lots to offer you, even if it's not Venice, obviously. I can advise you on a lot of things. It's very good value compared to the UK at the moment.
I'm very enamored of Puglia, actually.
Oh, Puglia is fantastic.
Yeah.
God, and it's cheap down there, man.
Yeah, very.
You can get, and the food. Oh my God!
I know. It's just.
Oh my
God! It's great. It's beautiful.
Have you got Italian? You were brought up part of the time in Italy, right?
Very, like, you know, my first 2 years or something. So I've never.
Is it pulling you? Do you think there's any pull from that element of it? Because obviously your parents.
Maybe, but yeah, my parents were definitely Italophiles. So.
So how much time have you spent in Italy?
My girlfriend and I have been going back to Puglia almost every year for, you know, a good few weeks. And we have this sort of like fantasy of retiring in Puglia, though.
So. I think you could do a lot worse, honestly. I think anywhere in Italy, frankly, it's just the people know how to live, you know. And if we've all got a limited amount of time left on this earth, you need to make the most of it, you know.
Yep.
On that bombshell.
I'll talk to you later. Have a good holiday.
All right, man. Have a great holiday.
All right, bye. All right, you too. Bye.
Well, that was something. What an amazing man. And what a truly creative character. Such a distinctive arrangement style as well. And that can be a double-edged sword, as we all know, because if we think about the way that fashions change, you know, that sound, the scritty sound was very, very distinctive, together with, obviously, Green's voice is very distinctive, but the arrangement style is very of its time, not in a bad way. I love it, personally. But anyway, he evolved over the years to work with all those amazing artists, you know, Sheely, Michelle Degacello, and Keisha, and Kelly Clarkson, and all that stuff, loads of it. His taste in music and his influences are really similar to mine, so that's probably why we got on so well. Feel free to email me, electronicallymartin@gmail.com. Ideas for the programme, ideas for guests. If you've got a way I can contact them, that's even better.
And also have a look at my Patreon page if you'd like to support keeping this independent and fun and advert-free. It's patreon.com/electronicallyhours. So there you go. Another year gone, 2 years of the show now. Amazing. And hopefully we've got enough to keep going on for quite a while yet. So have a great new year. Have a creative and healthy new year. Lots of love from Martin. Bye.